If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Welcome back to the weekly roundup on the Dialogue with Diwa de Boer and William McGimpsey on Reality Check Radio, where we discuss the happenings of the week in New Zealand and abroad. And it is now the 23rd week of the year. We're actually quite close to halfway through 2024 already. How the year is flying by, at least for me. Welcome to the show, William.
Thanks, Diwa. It's nice to talk to you again.
So first we get into the weekly free speech update, and we've had every week so far, and perhaps we will in into the future, but we've had a few more developments with the Australian eSafety Commissioner, who has, you know, we spoke about previously. She effectively spied on her opponents, people who are critical of the eSafety Commission. She also had a case against Elon Musk and Twitter in terms of the video that had circulated of the attack against the Christian bishop. And there have been some developments in this particular area. So I'm happy for you to sort of give us a little summary of what's changed in the last week there.
Well, the big development is that she's announced that she's dropped one of the lawsuits against Elon Musk's company X around the video of the stabbing of Bishop Marmari Emmanuel in the Wakeley Church. Now, what's important to note here is that there's more than one lawsuit going on. There's several, up to five, and at least two of them on this issue specifically, which is the global takedown order she issued for the video. And so she's dropped the federal court case in Australia, but the matter is still being pursued through, and I forget the name of the court off the top of my head, but there's another tribunal that the case is going to be heard in front of. Now, what was important about this case is it's a test of whether the eSafety Commissioner in Australia has the powers to censor a video like that globally. She issued the takedown order to X, and X actually geo-blocked the video in Australia. However, that wasn't good enough for the eSafety Commissioner. She argued that people in Australia could still access it through VPNs and various other means, and she pursued legal action against X to take it down globally. So we had the lawsuit. She's now withdrawn one of those lawsuits, but another one's still going on. The Free Speech Union of Australia speculates that, or perhaps it's more than speculation, that she's dropped this case because she's shopping around for a better judge. So that's one possible example. But the good news about her dropping the case, it's I'm not sure how good a news it really is. She still wants to censor the internet. She still wants to censor the internet globally. And there's still a number of court cases ongoing. But there's other revelations that have come out recently, and I think we discussed some of them last week. And that's around her spying on her political opponents. So she gets these meltweather reports, the commission as a whole does. And a lot of government departments use these sorts of reports to try and understand what the public thinks about them. So it's sort of an exercise in PR. But it seems that in Australia specifically, she's using it to keep tabs on her critics and what her critics are saying about her. At the same time, she pursued an injunction in the court to suppress the names and activities of her own organisation from being looked into by others. So that is another sort of hypocritical action going on in the background of that case.
And here in New Zealand, saw this week that there is someone by the name of Paul Thistle who's taking a case against a certain Mr. William McGimpsey to the Human Rights Commissioner. Now, what is this case here, and why are you being taken to the Human Rights Commission by this particular individual, Paul Thistle? And he's sort of well known, I guess, in online spaces, sort of a trans rights activist, and he's effectively a lobbyist, I guess, for trans rights, quite a radical leftist. And he's taken an issue with you. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about this.
So Paul Thistle is the chief executive of Countering Hate Speech Aotearoa. And how big and important an organisation that is remains in doubt. He may just be pretending he has that organisation behind him to make himself look more important on Twitter. We're not sure about that. But in any case, I've been contacted by the Human Rights Commission. They sent me an email just before Christmas, late last year, setting out that Paul wishes to take a case before the Human Rights Commission against me, basically because I spoke about the Great Replacement on Twitter. And his claim is that by speaking about the Great Replacement, you're inciting racial disharmony under Section 61 of the Human Rights Act, which is New Zealand's only hate speech law at the moment. It's inciting racial disharmony. Now, what's interesting is that all the tweets he cites, they're not hateful tweets. They're rather dispassionate discussions of the Great Replacement as a concept and what it means, without any over-the-top or personal attacks, over-the-top rhetoric or personal attacks or anything of that nature. So if this action goes ahead and it does, and it ends up with the some sort of Human Rights Commission or the tribunal having to make a decision, it's an interesting test case in whether you're actually just allowed to speak about the phenomenon of the Great Replacement publicly or online in New Zealand. Because there's nothing hateful about the way I've been discussing it. It's just whether you can discuss it at all, or whether there's something inherent in it that the Human Rights Commission thinks incites racial hatred. So it's very important for free speech. I think the Great Replacement is just a name for the phenomenon of falling white populations due to immigration. And you should be able to use that term to refer to that phenomenon. Now, it's not going to go straight to a hearing because I've opted for mediation, which you have the option to do. So you sit down in a room together and you talk it out and you see if you can reach some sort of compromise before legal action is taken. And so that will be the next step. At some point in the future, me and Paul will have to sit down and talk about the issue and see if there's some sort of solution or it can be reached short of taking the issue to court.
Is that going to be recorded for us?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know. It could be interesting, couldn't it, if we recorded it?
Well, that would certainly make for a very interesting piece of content, an interesting debate or friendly discussion. Who knows what it might be. For those who are listening on the radio, if you are wondering what the Great Replacement is, it was actually the subject of the first interview that I did with William and the first interview on the dialogue in general. So you can go back through the archives on RCR. You can find the episode that we did on the Great Replacement, which has got all of that information in it. And yeah, I guess he brought this case to you before you went on RCR and talked about it. So he's not including that in the complaint, but that could be quite interesting. Now,
I had forgotten about the case. It had sort of gone quiet and I didn't have access to my old Free Speech Union emails, which the Human Rights Commission were emailing, because I stopped working for the Free Speech Union a while ago. But the irony of Paul is that he's campaigning for hate speech laws, and yet his own Twitter is one of the more personally abusive accounts on Twitter, which I think, and that's a great advertisement, I think, for some of the ironies of hate speech laws.
Yeah, that's hate is in the eye of the beholder in this case. All right, that's their right. Argument. They get to hate all they want because they're doing it for a good cause. That's basically what it comes down to. Now, being called in front of the Human Rights Commission, basically, they're not like a legal body or a court that can summon you in the sense that you have to deal with this, or are you basically legally obligated to have to deal with this process, or it goes to court, you mentioned, or is that purely an internal thing for the Human Rights Commission that has no real impact on the law? Like, they have no way of making a civil or criminal declaration.
Well, the mediation initially is just a mediation. It can go to court and they can make a legal decision as to whether, in this case, what I'm doing counts as inciting racial disharmony. So, I mean, there have been decisions made on this sort of thing in the past, and it's quite a high bar to meet. So there's a lot of other cases some other cases have been taken around discussing what counts as inciting racial disharmony and what doesn't. And the courts have generally found in the past that it's quite a high bar. So, I mean, I would be surprised if it turned out that what I was doing counted legally as inciting racial disharmony, but I guess we have to wait and see.
And just out of curiosity, then what happens if somebody, say, disagrees to engage in a process at all with the Human Rights Commission? Like you mentioned, they can basically just sort of take it to court. Is that, can they take this somewhere without your cooperation?
I would have to seek further legal advice. This, I haven't sought legal advice on that yet, so I couldn't say.
Well, we will follow that with a bit of interest. As you've mentioned, it's sort of been going on in the background and not much has been happening. So I suspect this is not a hot issue that will develop at any pace at all. But if there's another development, if you do get to sit down with Paul and the Countering Hate Speech Aotearoa group, then I guess we'll hear about it on a future show.
I'll keep you informed.
Now, sort of adjacent to free speech, I wanted to include this in our free speech wrap-up, because this week the police commissioner, Andrew Koster, basically started lobbying against alcohol, saying that he believed that there should be a bunch of prohibitions, well, I say prohibitions, but restrictions enacted on the sale of alcohol at specific times and in particular situations. And Andrew Koster, he's the police commissioner. He's supposed to be in a role with the New Zealand police, not supposed to be political, not supposed to be lobbying. And I see that the Free Speech Union is actually made a press release about this, as have several other organizations, because I think it's quite outrageous to see the police commissioner effectively take on a very political role. And, you know, people might say, oh, he can use his free speech, but this is very much a position that's supposed to be impartial in terms of applying the law.
Yes. So it's a mix up of an operational function, which is police, with a policy advisory function or a function that's supposed to be decided through the political process. You can see why Andrew Koster is interested in it. If we are to take his claims at face value, alcohol is a significant cause of a number of police call-outs. And so it makes sense abstract sense for him to be interested in the issue and looking to, you know, reduce the use of police resources in this way. However, if you play that out and think about all the other areas of government, all the other operational areas, if all those other areas started thinking in a similar way, they would all be getting involved in lobbying the government for various things to make their job easier or to save themselves on resources. And that would, that's basically brings an end to the idea of political or ideological neutrality. That you have then you have the government lobbying the government. You know, you have the unelected branches lobbying the elected branches for what the policies should be, and it's the government talking to itself. And that then starts to compete with the desires and the values of the interests of ordinary people. So I don't think it's right that he's using his position to do things in this way, although the issues he's raising are legitimate issues that should be thought through.
Yeah, I was thinking that, you know, if whatever's causing issues for the police, they could very easily lobby for a whole bunch of restrictions to say, oh, most crimes are committed at night, you know, people should stay indoors, we should have a curfew. it could be extended indefinitely onto issues. And instead, the job of the police really is to actually deal with crime. Like, that's the job. So, okay, this particular crime is illegal, the police need to deal with that. And it seems to me that the police in some way have retreated from this goal of actually controlling crime and simply just enforcing the law, because they could just, you know, put people in prison for a long time. I guess the judiciary is in their way a little bit here. It's hard to tell, I guess, who's fully to blame or who could do more to reduce the crime in New Zealand. But the reality is, like, the more people that you lock up who commit crimes, the less there is overall. Usually it's a very small percentage of the population who commit the overwhelming number of crimes. So the more people you're able to prosecute and put away behind bars for longer periods of time will help to alleviate the problem of crime in New Zealand. And that seems like that's not been happening for the past few years. Obviously, the Labour Party had a policy to reduce the prison numbers, but it's just strange here to see the police kind of give up on actually dealing with real crime and start to complain about political issues.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. Your analysis is right that the best way of reducing crime is to put criminals in jail where they can't commit crime. Because, as you say, most crime, especially most violent crimes, committed by a very small amount of people. And, you know, people on the left and people on the, you know, let the criminals out of jail side of things often elide this point, and they focus on rehabilitation and ideas like this. And they claim that the claim is that you often hear is, well, when people get out of jail, they're likely to commit more crimes. And of course, what they say from that is prison doesn't work, and therefore we shouldn't have prison. But, you know, if people are committing crimes when you let them out of jail, the way I think about that is you should stop letting them out, and then you'd have less crime, right?
Yeah, we have a classic international example at the moment with the country of El Salvador, where they had a massive gang problem, the murder capital of the world, and they enacted a policy to imprison quite a large number of people. Anyone associated with a gang was basically imprisoned. I've heard numbers of like up to 1% of the population, which seems like a little bit high, but maybe say that it's true. And they saw like a 97% reduction in murders and other forms of violent crime. And which just goes to show the fact that, yeah, if these people are in prison, they're just not committing crimes. Like, that's how straightforward it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's enormously effective. It's one of the biggest turnarounds in terms of crime and justice in recent memory, following a very simple principle of locking them up. So if you do it right, it works.
Now, the very big political issue that sort of set New Zealand aflame in the past week, and we didn't talk about this last week, it was sort of just getting started when the budget had been announced and the various reactions were up in the air. You had a declaration made by the Maori Party saying that they wanted sort of independence and they were going to set up their own parliament. They put forward a petition, basically asking for people's consent to set up their own parliament. And that's something that's really dominated the headlines in the last week and a lot of the political fallout about that. So what's your initial thoughts, initial reaction, or I say initial reaction, it's been a week, obviously, since this announcement that Te Pāti Māori wants to form their own parliament that's separate to the main, the real parliament?
Well, I mean, I think there is, it's easy to be dismissive of what they're doing. And I think ultimately we still should be. But there is a legitimate human right that lies at the basis of what they're doing, and it's the right to self-determination, which is set out in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which New Zealand has signed up to. And that is the right of a people to decide their own destiny, so to decide what level of political control they have over their own people and community and future. The issue for the Maori Party is they're called the Maori Party, but they don't represent all Maori. They represent a minority of Maori. And it seems unlikely. I mean, we haven't had any recent polling on this that I'm aware of, but it seems unlikely that a majority of Maori would support what the Maori Party are doing. And that's you would really, to make a good case for what they're doing, you'd really need to at least get a majority of Maori to support it. And based on just their electoral numbers alone, you'd have to say it's probably not been achieved.
Putting aside issues of self-determination, there seem to be a lot of concerns from people around this being seditious, about there being treasonous or even inciting a rebellion or revolution against the legitimate government of New Zealand. So what are your views then on whether or not something like this could be seditious?
Well, I mean, as long as they're going about it in a peaceful way and making arguments rather than committing violent acts or terrorist acts or trying to place themselves outside of the laws within New Zealand, then I think what they're doing is still legitimate within the realms of legitimacy. And of course, we're welcome to argue against it, and I would argue against it, because historically, for most of the history of New Zealand, Maori and Pākehā have gotten on quite well, and we've had quite a good country. There's a bust up every year at Waitangi, but apart from that, we get along quite well. And at some points, at least, New Zealand's been regarded as one of the best little countries in the world. So, yeah, if at some point they begin operating outside the law or seeking to undermine the authority of the New Zealand government. Then it crosses the line into sedition and treason, making arguments, trying to win popular support. For me, is still within the realms of legitimacy.
And it's interesting you mentioned there that as well the good relationship that Maori and Pākehā have had in New Zealand, and obviously there have been problems, but the kind of revisionist history focuses very much on the negatives. And earlier on in the show, I've kind of went into some of the history, some of the contentious parts of history. But when you go through it all, I think the revisionists have basically created this story of the kind of a struggle in all of New Zealand history. They're kind of trying to bring that into the 21st century. And the Maori Party has kind of become the face of this racial struggle that they want to bring into New Zealand society. And as you've mentioned, it's a small percentage of Maori, at least for the moment, who are really buying into this, who really want separatism or who want self-determination. And on the whole, they seem to actually be quite happy with New Zealand society and being part of New Zealand as a unified, united society.
Yeah. So I mean, I think we've seen the importation of, woke grievance culture from the United States. And it's been imported into New Zealand, and it's making race relations worse in New Zealand needlessly. They teach this stuff in the schools and in the universities now. And that's having a negative effect on social cohesion. And it's not just happening in New Zealand, that's happening right around the Western world. It's the same sort of cultural Marxist, woke, racial grievance politics. Not good stuff. And it's ultimately not in the interests of anyone. That kind of politics and that kind of rhetoric isn't making anyone's life any better.
Some historical examples, I may just briefly mention them for the audience. Like, there used to actually be a Maori parliament in the turn of the century, 1900s to 1890s to about 1900, 1901. And these were replaced, that ultimately resulted in an act that established Maori councils around New Zealand, because the government was actually worried about this particular parliament. But you had members of parliament, New Zealand parliament, New Zealand government, who interacted quite positively with this self-proclaimed parliament. They listened to its concerns. It had a positive influence and support from almost all Maori around New Zealand, right? So, like, as you mentioned, compared to the Maori Party today, is very small support. That the historical examples of this happening actually had broad support, and then they ended up having some goal that they achieved that was integrated into the New Zealand parliamentary system and peacefully integrated into New Zealand's legal system. And yeah, it seems to be some attempt to revive that in a way that's disconnected from history. And like you said, I think that imported racial grievance from America largely is kind of what's driving this. And because they don't have that connection to the history, they don't actually have the understanding of why these things happen in New Zealand, why things organically developed in the way that they did across the 160 or so years, 180 years of New Zealand's government existing, that it's just not going to work. So
yeah, well, one
like,
of the
I'm
other
not worried, I'm not worried about like I'm not really worried about it because it's ultimately not based in anything that's going to take root, because it's disconnected from history.
Yeah, that's right. And I think one of the other currents that's sort of playing into this is that the treaty settlement process is nearing its end. And that's been a big part of, like, a central focal point of Maori Pākehā relations in New Zealand for a long time now. And there's, people talk about the treaty gravy train. And once that process of reconciliation and making good on the bad things that happens in the past comes to an end, I think many in Māoridom are wondering what sort of leverage or what sort of institutions they're going to have left to use to bring their interests and their values to the fore in New Zealand without that institution anymore. So I think that is, and that's a legitimate thing. I think that it's legitimate for them to worry about that and to consider what might come next if and when the Waitangi Tribunal is folded up and goes away?
Yeah, it's very easy for us to say, like, okay, no, you know, we're all one people, we're all in this together, and don't worry about anything. But really, if you put yourself in the shoes of like an ethnic minority anywhere, where whatever the context is, if you had some form of influence or power that you felt was slipping away, you would be upset. If you were a member of that particular group, you would be upset because you'd think, hey, we're a minority group and we're losing this particular political influence and power that we had. So it's they do have a genuine, like you've mentioned, they do have a genuine natural concern that anybody would have in that situation. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of it. Again, I don't see what they're currently doing going anywhere. I don't see any particular reason to be concerned about it, but yeah, I understand there are a lot of people who are. Maybe we'll get a lot of feedback on this, people who are really worried that this will be damaging. From the people that I've spoken to who are loosely connected with the Maori Party or who used to be, who are in those circles again, they are not overly concerned about it either. They believe a lot of this is driven by a small number of egotistical people, you could say, people, you know, a number of powerful individuals who are specifically worried about losing their power in the system. And it's not so much the common man who's worried about, you know, missing out on anything.
Yeah, well, that could be right. I think the concerns of ordinary Maori are perhaps detached from the concerns of the insiders. That's something that goes not just for Maori, but for everyone.
And this is a good segue into the next big topic of the week before we go into international subjects. Very, very quickly, I think we won't cover this in much detail on allegations that have been brought up against the Maori Party and the Manurewa Marae, that they used census data and even vaccine data as well over the years for the political campaign of the Maori Party candidate. So Stats New Zealand has announced an investigation as well. There's potentially a case for the Privacy Commissioner to get involved, the Electoral Commission, even, you know, the police. It's possible that all of this, you know, could really blow up in the face of particularly John Tamahiri and the Tamahiri family, who have had a lot of influence over, I guess, Maori politics, as we've just discussed, as a family, as an individual. In his case, he's like the president of the Maori Party. He's running campaigns. He controls millions of dollars of what he calls the Maori economy, basically all of these charitable groups that he is a part of his web. And you've got a number of whistleblowers now basically saying, hey, this guy's got too much power. It's all going, you know, there's a fair bit of corruption, or at least rumors of corruption, allegations of corruption, potentially evidence of things that have been done in a very dodgy way. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that develops. Unfortunately, it's very much a developing story, so it's hard to make a judgment on it. But I'm sure you've got an initial impression on what's going on here with the Manurewa Marae, with the census data and the vaccine data that potentially has been used for political purposes.
Yeah, I mean, well, the issue is John Tamahiri, he's got his fingers in a lot of pies. So he's the chief executive of Whanau Ora, the chief executive of the Waiparira Trust, and the president of the Maori Party. And so he is working with the government on a number of nonpartisan initiatives, such as helping them get people to fill in the census. But what he's done is he's taken those opportunities that's been provided to him for helping in the census and helping with the vaccine rollout, and then he's stolen the data that's been made available to him by Stats New Zealand and by the health service in order to help with electioneering on behalf of the Maori Party. And so that's really serious, especially when you consider that the seat in question was lost by Tamaki Makaurau, was lost by Labour MP Pini Henare by a mere 42 votes. And so some of these election shenanigans could very well have made the difference between him winning and losing the seat. So the allegations are that they collected personal information and from the census data, and then they used it to contact people in order to encourage them to vote for the Maori Party and to change to the Maori role. And similarly, with the vaccine rollout, they got their phone numbers. They were going to send phone text messages to people to encourage them to come along to the Marae and get vaccinated. But then they, in the election, they used those phone numbers in order to send reminder texts for them to come along and vote for the Maori Party and change roles. And that's not all. They also offered inducements to them. They sent out people to these people's houses with the voting forms, both the census forms and the change of role to the Maori role forms. And so these partisan and non-partisan things were all rolled together by the people working at Manurewa Marae. And so that is corruption. There does need to be some sort of investigation launched into this. It's a breach of people's privacy. It's a breach of electoral rules as well. And there's possibly other things that have gone wrong here as well. I think it's a very serious fraud case that needs to be investigated seriously.
Yeah, and you mentioned, potentially a fraud case, potentially even which would result in criminal charges and so on. Like this could get very, very serious very, very quickly. And I suspect very much that we're in the early days of this. And yeah, it's potential that hubris has gotten the best of John Tamahere and the others, I guess, who have been at the top of this particular pyramid, or the gravy train, it has all kinds of names. And perhaps they thought that they were too big to fail. They'd amassed a large enough empire, enough influence, and sheer hubris got the best of them.
Yeah. And there's a culture, and this is the other thing I'd like to point out, there's a culture within the public sector of, it's hard to know how to put this, of the sort of Maori organizations are cut some slack, right? And
the bigotry, was it, I can't remember who coined the phrase, but the soft bigotry of low expectations.
It's something like that. And if you know, people are reluctant to ask questions and to put too much oversight in for fear of being called racist and for fear of, you know, being seen to be too tough on Maori. And, you know, people like the idea of these initiatives that work with Maori groups and Maori organisations within the public sector. So there's a reluctance to really examine it closely and to hold it to account. And I think that the lax oversight here from the government officials, unelected officials, is another key aspect of this case.
Thank you very much for your insights there. And last week we didn't get around to any international issues, so we're going to do some catch up for the next 10, 15 minutes or so on some of these developing international stories. Some of them will connect to New Zealand a little bit and others won't. I'll definitely start with the New Zealand ones, even though I know everyone will want us to talk about Nigel Farage's return in the United Kingdom or Trump's conviction that took place last week. But first, just a little bit closer to home, New Caledonia has been in the news in the last month or so, perhaps even a little bit longer. It's a French colony. It's had a number of protests, riots, several people have been killed, and even New Zealanders have been evacuated. So the New Zealand Defence Force evacuated, I believe, 300 personnel, people mostly of New Zealand background, and perhaps they came back for a few more in this past week because of difficulty people had of getting out to the right extraction locations. So what's going on in New Caledonia, which is, I believe, the only other nation officially above water on the Zealandian continent, and so it's technically part of our territory, right? But the French have it. So what's going on there, and why is it falling apart?
Well, like you say, New Caledonia is a French colony, and its population is roughly 40% indigenous. They're called Kanak people or Kanak people. I don't know exactly how to pronounce it. So 40% of the population is indigenous Pacific Islanders of some sort. And around 25% of the population are European people, French-type people, settlers who have lived there for a while. And they had quite a restrictive voting system where you had to be a citizen to vote, and there were some other strict rules as well, which were a wee bit complicated. France decided to pass electoral reforms to allow residents who had lived there for 10 years to vote. So it's an expansion of the number of people who were able to vote. And that expansion, it favoured the colonists, the French colonist population, more than it did the indigenous population. And that's what spurred the unrest and the violence. It was a protest, a violent protest against the expansion of the franchise in a way that disfavored the indigenous minority. And so again, you've got these two things playing out against each other. It sort of reminds us of what's going on in New Zealand. You've got an indigenous minority who want to ensure their own control of their own destiny, ensure their right of self-determination, against the other people who want to ensure voting rights for all people, so to ensure that all people can vote. And those two things are playing off against each other here and causing the unrest.
Yeah, these are two core pillars of liberal society, effectively, you know, sort of progressive democratic values, especially in the modern world in the 20th and 21st century. Kind of the world order was built on this idea of democracy for everyone. Everyone had to have a franchise, universal franchise. Everyone gets to vote. And then at the same time, kind of trying to uphold indigenous rights and the rights of native populations. And you can see them in New Caledonia really be pushed to the edge and to conflict. And I guess the size of the indigenous population there is a key factor, because they have like a large minority, but they'll never quite have enough. And with these electoral reforms, that kind of ensures that, you know, they could never win an election again, right? So I can absolutely see why they're upset. And it's kind of do or die, that's how they're treating it, I guess, which is why it's literally turned into people dying, because it's an existential threat to them, to their self-determination.
That's right. And both those principles are key principles in the entire international order, aren't they? I mean, the reason we have separate nation states is based on the principle of self-determination. And the reason we have democracy is the idea of everyone should have to vote. So, and there's a lot of places where these two fundamental rights are coming into conflict. And another one would be the Israel-Palestine conflict, where both of those rights are implicated. It's implicated in indigenous rights movements around the world. And so there's a real tension there that's driving a lot of conflicts.
Yes, I see a lot of these decolonization advocates who are cheering on the violence in New Caledonia, because that's kind of, they want to decolonize New Caledonia and kick out the French. And they kind of see that transplanted, or that idea is in all of these countries. So New Zealand, New Caledonia, Israel, Gaza. It's like the same story that they see of like the struggle of the indigenous population against the colonizing force. And that's what's driving the guys, these solidarity movements, where it's all connected. It's all the same story. It's all the same part of the same story, because they see themselves as part of that struggle, just that indigenous rights struggle against colonization, against the evil white man.
Yes.
But so part of the Israel-Gaza conflict, and we could talk about that in a little bit more detail, but there was a New Zealand connection in the last week, lasted 19 days, actually. It was a hunger strike in New Zealand. A former actor, I'd never heard of him. I guess most people hadn't heard of him, but his name's Will Alexander. Publicity stunt, very successful publicity stunt. For 19 days, he went on hunger strike, refused to eat until the New Zealand government would intervene and for a ceasefire in Israel and Gaza. As if the Israeli government would care what the New Zealand government thinks. But, you know, I guess it's all about the symbolism of it and the gesture of getting the New Zealand government to make a statement, which the New Zealand government didn't do. After 19 days, he got a little bit hungry and decided to give up. And I've seen just 2 days ago as well that another teenager this time has announced a hunger strike, Ren Fisher. And the articles speaking about this completely neglect to mention this is a child of a journalist who's making this particular protest. But it's the same hunger strike protest, in this case, a transgender individual who is a child of a journalist. You can make that connection there, I guess, with the ideological slant of the media. So why are we seeing these hunger strikes on international issues? I mean, and they're not really hunger strikes either, right? Sort of publicity stunts for international issues. What do they actually hope to get out of the New Zealand government?
Well, it's just the latest trendy thing, Palestine, isn't it? So I think that's a large part of the motivation. But the New Zealand government has been quite even-handed, in my view, and it's in the way it's behaved towards the Israel-Palestine conflict. I think we've, as a country, we haven't taken sides. We've condemned the Hamas terrorist attack. We've accepted Israel's right to defend itself, but we've also weighed in saying that the attacks that Israel have done are disproportionate, and other measures as well in support of the Palestinian population. So I think, you know, our government's been pretty even-handed.
Yes, even Foreign Minister Winston Peters was saying that there's going to be a sort of a when we recognize a Palestinian state, not saying if, but basically saying, you know, there will be a Palestinian state, which you think is a very strong statement from a Foreign Minister, Winston Peters, and yet it's not enough, obviously. And he's called for ceasefires as well, I believe. This is one of the things that I sort of see these protesters saying, that the government needs to call for a ceasefire. I mean, I'm looking through Winston Peters' statements and I'm seeing him call for a ceasefire. So I don't, I guess a successful publicity stunts is what these are. When you look at what's actually going on, you couldn't possibly accuse this government of being, you know, pro-Zionist in any particular sense.
Well, I think the dam is breaking internationally in terms of more and more European countries recognizing Palestinian statehood. So recently we had, and I'm going to struggle to remember the countries, but Ireland was one of them, Spain, I think, and was it Norway? Do you know that?
Yeah, I don't quite remember, but there were three of them, and it sounds like you might be right.
Yeah, and there's indications a couple of other European countries may also recognize Palestinian statehood. Comments I've made elsewhere are that, you know, one of the reasons you have a state is to provide for the collective defense of your people. And does anyone really think that the current situation between Israel and Palestine is going well? I mean, what could go worse by granting the Palestinians statehood? The only peoples who really experience genocide are stateless peoples. If you have a state, you have to destroy the state first before you can genocide the people. And so nation states, having your own nation, having your own state, and this is the lesson that the Jewish people learned too, which is why they formed the State of Israel after World War II, after the Holocaust. And so those same lessons apply just as much to the Palestinian people as they do to the Jewish people who formed their own state in Israel.
Yeah, and often, like you said, the formation of states and these kinds of conflicts is not pretty. It's not a clean thing. The unfortunate situation, though, there is looking at the data, the Israeli, looking at even opinion polling, looking at the members of the different political parties and what they think. Basically, the view of the Israeli people is that they're not doing enough to take out Hamas. They're not doing enough. You know, like that's the centrist position in Israel, is that Benjamin Netanyahu is not doing enough to take out Hamas, that he's being too soft, he's listening to too much international outrage. And it may be hard for people to understand that, like just look at that, but that's the normal centrist position in Israel, is that Hamas is not being taken care of well enough. And then if you look at polling on like the Palestinian side as well, you don't see anybody who's sort of, you know, there's no real opposition, like there's no genuine opposition that's able to be formed against the kind of tactics that Hamas employs. You know, it's to us, at least to me, a very bizarre situation. I don't know if you have anything to say to that. Like, you see some kind of peace, like peaceful resolution, or some kind of truce situation where you do get a stable Palestinian state? Or I don't know how much to trust these polling numbers, but every single time I look at them, every single time I look at any kind of what I hope is reliable indications of what people on the ground are thinking, and it doesn't look like there's any chance at all of having a stable Palestinian state.
There's a reason this conflict has been very hard to solve for so long. And one of the main reasons, probably the main reason, is that both parties willing to kill and to die to control the land. The original Jewish Zionist plan was to control all the areas that are currently in where the Palestinians live, in Gaza and the West Bank. And a two-state solution where there was an independent Palestinian state would mean that those plans couldn't be brought to fruition. So that's what you're up against. It's a very difficult problem when both sides are willing to kill and die, but
it's often, basically all wars are like this, right? They're all wars for land, whether you're studying the New Zealand wars, whether you're looking at the Ukraine-Russian war today, looking at Israel-Gaza. people want to control the land. There are two sides to the conflict. Usually there's a winner and a loser, basically. But it's a strange situation here where, due to international involvement, basically, there's no one side can't gain complete dominance over the other side. And it's been going on for 70 years nearly. So it's just a very unique, bizarre situation. I remember was the late great Rush Limbaugh, who would say about the Palestinian peace process or the Middle East peace process, is that it was impossible. It would never happen. It was designed not to happen. He said, you could have your little kid, Tommy, he could be 5 years old. What do you want to be when you grow up, Tommy? And like, oh, I want to work in the Middle East peace process. And he says, you don't need to worry, because by the time that Tommy is 20, 30 years old or whatever, the Middle East peace process is still going on. So you can have your little kids and they can grow up to be involved in the Middle East peace process, because it's a permanent thing. The peace process is the thing.
Well, one thing to bear in mind, though, is that for all this time, up until this point, Israel has enjoyed backing from Western nations. And that backing is beginning to fall away now. And so that may change the relative balance of power. And it may be enough to bring Israel, who is the stronger party militarily in the Israel-Hamas conflict, or in the broader Israel-Palestine conflict, it may be enough to bring them to the negotiating table and accept a two-state solution. That's one thing to bear in mind anyway.
All right. Well, we're not going to solve this conflict, so let's carry on. The election in the UK is probably the big one to watch, and it's going to be a few weeks. I think we'll cover it in little bits for the next few weeks, because there will be developments there. The big development this week has been Nigel Farage returning as the leader of Reform UK, and he's standing in an electorate there. I'm not sure if they call them electorates. They might have different names, like boroughs or ridings. And Clacton, I believe, a little seaside town. And the polling, before he came back, basically, a poll was done. If Nigel Farage is running, would you vote for him? And he came out on top there. And the polls from this week show that Reform UK would win at least 3 seats. So for the first time ever, Nigel Farage is on track to be in the UK Parliament, having been involved in UK politics for decades. He's actually now, for the first time, polling to be there. The suicidal campaign that Sunak is running, Rishi Sunak, is the Conservatives are polling to end up like 60 or 70 seats at the moment, a total wipeout of the Conservative Party. I mean, what happened there? 15 years, and what hill did they choose to die on? What killed the UK Conservative Party?
Immigration killed them. They allowed in too much immigration, record high rates of immigration, same as we're seeing in many other Western countries. And this all occurred in the shadow of Brexit. Brexit was motivated, and Nigel Farage was heavily involved in that Brexit, of course. But Brexit was motivated by a few factors. One, independence from the EU, but also a desire to cut back on immigration. And although the Brexit vote won, the feeling or the vibe that went along with it, at least, of reducing immigration wasn't followed through by the Conservative leadership, who were in power for, who've been in power for 12 years now. And people are very upset about this in Britain, that they've got problems with their NHS, their health service. They've got housing problems similar to we have in New Zealand. Basic public services are stretched. Their immigration system is not working for them. And that's led many young conservatives in the UK to campaign to be openly advocating for 0 seats for the UK Conservative Party, to punish them for betraying the country on immigration in this way. And so Nigel Farage running in the race, he's going to win a lot of that vote, and he's going to further contribute to really decimating the Conservative Party in that election.
And there is potentially a downside for the UK here, is that they end up with a massively powerful Labour Party like we had in New Zealand. Imagine kind of like Jacinda Ardern's government with an absolute majority, but then in the United Kingdom. However, the Labour government we had here actually turned out to be quite incompetent. As much as people hated them and how horrible they were, they didn't actually get a huge amount done that couldn't be undone quickly. There is a lot of concern in the UK that the all-powerful Labour Party will do even more permanent damage. I've seen Peter Hitchens in particular arguing Peter Hitchens, who's argued for the destruction of the Tories for the last two decades, has now turned around and said, no, if Labour wins, it's over. They're going to do even worse. So, I mean, what's your view here? Is it going to be even more disastrous to have the Labour Party there for 5 years than it would be to not punish the Tories? Like, what's the calculation? Clearly, people are making this calculation in the UK, but how do you factor into that calculation? Is it a genuine concern?
Of course, it's a genuine concern. However, if the Tories are not punished for their failures on immigration, then there'll never be any incentive for them to change their policy. So in the longer term, I guess the hope is that the punishment, punishing them electorally for their betrayal on immigration, while it may lead to a bad electoral outcome in the short term with the Labour government putting in bad policies, hopefully it encourages the Tories to change their policies on immigration so that party can be rebuilt to be a low immigration party and then come back and win and put things right afterwards. I guess that's the hope.
And we will see how that develops. And again, the polling week after week will be the thing to watch. How many seats Nigel Farage is able to pick up. His current goal, he has said, is to become the leader of the opposition. So he wants the most seats in the opposition. He doesn't believe he can beat Labour, but he would need, you know, to become the leader of the opposition, he would need to clock in about 70 or 80 seats at the moment. And he's currently, like I said, he's currently polling on 3. That's only after a few days in. So we will keep an eye on this. I believe the election is about four weeks away now, the 4th of July, easy to remember, which is just under 4 weeks away. So it's quite a tight race that they're running, which is nice. It's always horrible to have these long, drawn-out elections. Like we see in the United States, Donald Trump was convicted the other week. We didn't really talk about it last week. I don't think we're going to talk about it this week, actually. I'm just going to wrap things up. I'm going to leave that hanging there for people because he still has to be sentenced. And I think that's probably the more interesting part of the story. And he also, you know, we also need to see some more polling to see if how it changes the odds of him winning the election in the United States. But if you'd like to give just like a very quick impression or prediction on that, I'm going to give you the chance right at the end here. Otherwise, I think it's better for us to go into this into more detail when we actually have something concrete, like polling data, like Trump being sentenced to something. Maybe you want to make a prediction. You know, is it going to help him, hurt him? Is he going to prison or not? And then we'll revisit that in a few weeks.
He's only growing stronger.
Well, that's a good. I like that prediction. I'm gonna save it. I'm writing it down, or maybe we'll take the audio and we'll see what happens in a few weeks, and we'll see if you're right. I do hope you're right. I think many people listening hope that you're right, and we will find out. If you tune in to the weekly wrap up here on the Dialogue on RCR every single week, every Friday afternoon, we'll go over the previous week or the previous few weeks worth of stories. And we will keep you updated, especially on these developing ones, especially these elections we're watching overseas as they happen. So that's it for this afternoon. Thank you very much for joining me, William. And just remind people where they can find you.
You can find me on Twitter at William McGimsey, at The Zeitgeist NZ. And there's also a YouTube account which contains many of my podcast appearances, The Zeitgeist NZ as well.
Well, thank you very much. And to the listeners, stay put, and we will be right back after this break.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.